Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name's Dan Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith, and today we are joined by Corey Smith.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing so well. How are you guys?
Good.
We've just been, like, chatting for the past 45 minutes.
Yeah,
for real. It's been really great.
It's felt like five.
Yeah, it has. Well, it's also, I'm really glad for it because I always don't want to solicit things like this because, like, I critique myself enough, but I'm going to go for it. If you listen a bunch, let us know if you've noticed plosives in the past and if you notice them more or less now.
Yeah, we switched out one of the microphones.
Yeah, and I've been very critical about it for myself for a very long time, but we did switch out one of the microphones. And it's a weird thing. So if you're an audio person, maybe this is interesting. And I'm so sorry, Corey.
Ooh, Daniel. That
we're, like, no, this jumping is great.
Daniel, I heard a plosive from you.
I know. Well, that's the thing is, this is a nicer... This is what I'm realizing is for podcasting specifically, if you are using nicer microphones... You hear plosives more. And I think part of it is because we were talking about this, like when you're in a, when you're doing a radio, like studio level podcast, like not podcast, but radio show, me reverse engineering the, like, when you're doing like a podcast on the radio, like what is that called? Like, what was I saying? Oh, I think that there's more at hand for you to make a like high quality microphone not have plosives. But when, you know, we're in an apartment, there's a lot of room noise, like we don't have everything like clear and dry and beautiful, like for a long time the idea of, well, a nicer microphone will work for no matter what and it'll get a more direct sound, but I think it's so sensitive that it's more plosive-y. So now we're all, except for me, I'm on a like a decent microphone, and you two are on $20 microphones.
Hello.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, and so the quality is less, but it'll be less.
Oh, I'm a fan of the ride or die $20 microphone.
It's solid.
Come at me, $500 microphones. My $20 microphone will kick your ass. It will be so good.
Yeah, and I, well, because I think that, because it was the microphone that was there, and so another piece to all of this, there's actually a seating mix-up. So, not mix-up, but kind of difference.
Like a... Yeah.
Oh, because we haven't talked about the Moody thing. I'm so sorry that we're just like, this is the most aggressively we've not been. Well, Corey, you're back. You've been on the show before.
Hello, yes. Almost a year ago, I think.
Yeah.
Really?
Pretty much exactly a year ago.
Yeah.
That feels like, it feels like so much.
Corey getting in touch with us has a tradition at this point where Corey will reach out to us toward the end of a calendar year and then... That is around the time that I'm burned out on emails, and I'll see that email and be like, wow, that looks really cool. I should get back to this person. And then I don't. And then I reach, and then I remember, oh God, that email. And then I reply back and I go, I hope it's not too late to have you on. So yeah, that happened last year, but this time we ran into Corey at a Whole Foods. And I was like, Corey, you emailed me. Is it too late?
Here it is. And that's never too late.
It's never too late.
What it really is that I plan, I'm like, oh, it's the holiday season. I have so much time to get a bunch of work done.
Absolutely.
I can definitely do a show at the beginning of the year, mm-hmm. Which like never turns out to be the case. Like it's always like the holiday happens and I've done no work and suddenly I've signed up to do a show in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate... but I appreciate the serendipity of finding you two in a Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah. Well, because we're never in a Whole Foods. We're never there.
I think that was like
we went there to buy a huge Whole Foods all year. We went there to buy a huge container of vegan butter.
Wow.
Like a gallon-sized, like country crock almost looking thing of vegan butter.
Huge container of vegan butter for $10 that has lasted us a month.
Oh, beautiful. So, okay, so vegan butter, is this just margarine?
Yes, but also without, because margarine, like stock margarine has...
Has like mono and diglycerides, which are not vegan.
Mm-hmm. And they put whey in it, I think.
Oh, wow.
I think. There's something in it that's dairy.
Well, so margarine has whey, but then I can't believe it's not butter, does not have whey, but it has mono and diglycerides.
Mm-hmm.
But we use this... We use this butter called Earth Balance,
mm-hmm.
that is specifically vegan. And it's...
Well, and I like the... We also had the I Can't Believe It's Not Butter. They have a vegan version. That's fucking great. Because I grew up on I Can't Believe It's Not Butter. Like, that was that was the household.
Oh, we just had fucking butter.
Well, I mean, in Wisconsin, you really can't.
Land of Lakes.
Yeah.
Something.
No, we were... a lot of my family is Irish. And so we did Irish butter.
Kerrygold.
Kerrygold.
Wow. Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The butter in my household growing up was Land O'Lakes, which was butter, but it had olive oil in it so that it was easier to spread.
Ooh.
Huh.
Yeah.
Huh. Nice.
That's really something.
No, I just, like, I appreciate that. Like, I'm a big olive oil person.
And it's great. It's a gift to all of us.
I like that we're just spending a good time talking about fats right at the top of the
episode. Oh, gotta love... God bless you, fats.
Okay, so the only other thing that I want to mention before that has nothing to do with you before we get into it.
Amazing, please.
Is Moody thing, which is we realized something. There was a breakthrough today. For the longest time, whenever we have someone on, we've always said whoever's sitting in the throne gets the cat, because Moody will always sit in the throne seat, because we thought that that was the seat that was most comfortable for lap. Like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it creates the best lap. When you sit in it, the lap that's made from that seat is the best lap. But then we realized that, oh, I'm so sorry. I hope it's not because I was talking about her too much. She just got off of Corey's lap. But Corey graciously took the not throne chair. I don't know if it's gracious.
I don't know.
Anyway, but
he just chose the not throne chair. I said, choose a chair, and he chose not the throne. Now I'm in the throne. Damn it.
And while Corey was not in the room, Moody got on Maureen's lap. And we were like, oh, Maureen, will you be in the Elite Lap Society? Will she stay in your lap the whole podcast episode?
Which you'd think, because she's my cat. But then as soon as Corey came back, she was like, nah.
Immediately.
Got up.
Into Corey's lap.
So it has nothing to do with the chair.
It everything to do with the stranger.
With the newest lap.
Yeah. Which is kind of like at this point, like, you know how Pavlov did thing? Like, what did Pavlov do that made him...
I'm sorry, what?
Obviously, I know I've mentioned Pavlov so many times on the show because, like, Moody's the Pavlov's dog of cats, where she knows there's a person in the room. She knows they're going to be there for an hour, so she'll frequently get in their lap. But my curious question is, did he do a study? Like, what was that? Like, did he just have a dog that he was like, let's see if I can get your mouth to water every time?
I think it was a study. I think he was like Dr. Pavlov, and he wanted to, like, he was testing the impact of, like, positive reinforcement or something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah. My half remembered version of it is that he rings a bell, gives a treat.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon rings a bell and the dog's mouth starts to water regardless of whether or not there's a treat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so something about, like, unconscious or, like, learned behaviors based on a stimulus, I think.
Yeah.
But the last time I honestly learned about this was in high school. So
right. All I'm really looking to have happen is have the cultural significance.
Sure.
You know?
Well, you know what? It landed.
I want everyone to...
You did a great job.
Hey, Daniel. Ding, ding.
Lap syndrome. Lap. Pavlov's lap.
So you have a show coming up.
I have a show coming up.
So this is part of the New Prairie School. This is under the New Prairie School umbrella, which is the
overarching project, which I've been working on for the past, like, I think 5 years or so.
Shows
no sign of stopping.
Great.
Under, like, the New Prairie School umbrella, there have been so many different iterations of that. So it's been like an art book. It has been a stage show, which happened last January, which is why I was on the show last January. An immersive performance inside of the Colvin House, which is in Edgewater. It's also been a series of sort of performative interventions and video pieces that that I made in Kansas at the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve. It's like an essay that is being published this coming fall in Belt Publishing with the Midwest Architecture Anthology. So it's a lot of different things. And essentially it revolves around Frank Lloyd Wright and his notions of organic architecture. Frank Lloyd Wright, for those of you that don't know, is arguably the most famous American architect. He is very lauded in the world. I don't know if he entirely deserves all of those lauds, but he like comes up a lot when we talk about architecture. He also claimed the Midwest as sort of his chief inspiration, right? Mm-hmm. The style that he helped pioneer was called the Prairie Style, and it's these houses that are sort of long and low. And he said that they were reflective of the North American continent, of this, like, of the prairie. And he called that relationship between the landscape and the house organic architecture. I have a lot of beefs with Frank Lloyd Wright as a person and as, like, a figure. He's, like, a very complicated individual. Mm-hmm. I don't love all of his work, but I do really respect it. I think he's a great designer. And a lot of his work looks really beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I'm particularly excited about that, like, notion of organic architecture, and specifically the notion of sort of grand inspiration coming from the landscape of the Midwest. So the New Prairie School project comes at this, like, idea in from a lot of different angles. This most recent incarnation is a performance piece called Essay on the Emil Bach House, which happens at the Emil Bach House in Rogers Park. It's at the corner of Sheridan and Jarvis. It is one of the few Frank Lloyd Wright houses in the city of Chicago, and it happens 2 weekends from now, so that's February 9 and 10. We are leading several performative architecture tours through the residence. So there are 7 tours a day on Saturday and Sunday, starting at 1 p.m., and the last tour, I think, is at like 9 p.m. They're about 45 minutes long, and we will gather as an audience outside on the sidewalk. We will, like, check in, make sure everyone's good, and then we will all head inside of the building. And there is where things get weird. myself and the ensemble of 4 other musician performers are occupying the house, and we will be performing music that is like both inspired by but also sort of contradictory of and playing with the story and the interpretation of the house. There will be a long unguided portion of the piece where audience members are free to walk around the house and experience a Frank Lloyd Wright house sort of on its own terms, and be able to experience it in real time as if it were, you know, just a house. It's my hope that this performance sort of reframes the experience of architecture and the experience of, like, time and space, and allows all of us, like myself included, but also the audience, to develop, like, an actual relationship with this structure. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit annoyed with the institution of the architecture tour, which I think provides a lot of facts and a lot of information, but not a whole lot of, like, emotional experiences. I'm interested in remedying that and trying to, like, figure out what we can do.
So this is something that I'm familiar with, because so the house I grew up in was very beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was an arts and craft style home, like a lot of just, like, really beautiful features and stuff like that. And my mom recently moved out of that house, but she, what was so interesting is that my relationship with that house was, oh, you know, that's where we watch movies. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is where, like, you know, that's the chair I sit in when I have the flu. Like, that's, you know, this is, it's very, it was very much like, Like, oh, this is where I went because I was so embarrassed that one time. Mm-hmm. So I under, but people come in for the first time, they're like, wow, what a beautiful home. Which, like, of course, of course it is a beautiful home. But to me, I was just like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But, like, let's just hang out. Like, let's just chill. Mm-hmm. Because it's, to me, it's amazing when a house is beautiful. But it's so much more amazing to me when people can take a space that, yes, is beautiful, but build relationships to it and in it and actually live in it.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's frustrating to me, like, walking around this, because I, when you were saying, like, you know, there's a lot of information, but not a lot of relation, you know, a lot of information, but not a lot of relationship building. It's like, these are homes, not a museum.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it, and the, like, the city of Chicago is just, like, filled with these architecture tours, which are sort of like, a function of tourism too, which is, like, a really interesting weird element to it. Yeah. But yeah, but, like, what does it mean to be in a house that no one lives in? Is, I think, a really puzzling question that is very true about a lot of the, like, the Frank Lloyd Wright houses that exist in the city of Chicago. There are a couple that people live in, but there are at least two where people don't. And it's, they're sort of puzzling artifacts.
I'm really glad you're here for another reason, which is something that I've been, and I wonder, I want to go back and listen to the last time we talked and listen to a few, see if I can find a few other instances of this where I've always enjoyed performance art. I think that anything that does not fall under a, and it, this, the way that I'm verbalizing this will make more sense as I go through this. Anything that does not fall under a particular structure has always been very interesting to me as an audience member. As a journalist, I've been finding it very difficult to talk with people that I respect and people that I know appreciate the same things that I do and put into words what it is that, like, we appreciate about it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I've had great conversations about it, and it's always, like, I don't think I'm like, I'm not looking back at this and going, like, oh, this sucks. Like, oh, but it's an interesting thing because you, as a journalist, you want to be able to, in as few words as possible, almost put something into a box, but you don't want to do that, of course. And but the thing that I've had kind of an epiphany about in the last couple months, not an epiphany, like, it's, you know, a thought about, is there more to talk about when it comes to performance art, when it comes to multimedia work, is there more to talk about what it is specifically not striving to be? And I think that is a really interesting way of thinking about it, because before it's like, okay, what are your goals? Like, what do you want this to be? But I think that for people that enter the space, it's not that. Like, there are goals, right? But it's not, the goal isn't A plus B equals C. It's, is it a rejection of, so let me now actually ask you a question. Do you find that when you're working in the art that you're making, that you have something that is like an anti-goal, like the opposite, like a thing of, I want to go as far as possible from this. And, and how would you put that into words? Like, what is that?
Oh gosh. Yeah. That is an excellent question, and I don't know if I entirely have an answer to it. But here's what I can tell you is that I have often struggled with what to call my work, not because I personally want to define it, but because it's difficult to communicate to other people what I do. And hello, kitty. Hello. And the beautiful cat has now just joined me on my lap. But I've settled on performance art for a couple different reasons. Sort of the first being that, like, Laurie Anderson uses the word performance art, and I, like, my work is very indebted to hers. So I was like, okay, that word will work. But second is that I think that performance art, the framework of performance art historically, is that of, like, using modes of performance as a medium, which, like, I am very excited about, which is to say that it's, like, it's not even trying to break the box as it is being aware of where the boxes are and how quickly you can move between them. Because I don't actually think you can really break a box. You can just sort of start making bad dance, right?
At least the conceptual box, because like it always will exist. Like it's yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. But
no,
it's
totally
interesting. Like it's fat because that's what you're really. That is the thing I think, because I think that a lot of people that enter these newer mediums, or rather like want to make something new out of the mediums they know, enter this space of how, like because it's usually people that are trained, it's usually people that have some degree of awareness of the boxes that already exist, but don't want to just do the same thing. They want to do something new.
Yeah.
And so it's like because that's the thing I think for me is it a thing where we need to better verbalize the exploratory experimental space, or is the verbalization like is the being able to step away from a box like should we acknowledge? Let me come at this from another angle. Do you in the rehearsal process and kind of the development process? Do you find you take on a more analytical headspace, or do you take on a more doing first headspace?
Oh, wow. Yeah, what a good question. I feel like I am very often in the analytical space, but should be more in the doing space. But I think that's just sort of my own my own approach to art making is like thinking through things a lot and like doing a lot of research. But I think that like any practitioner of you know, experimental theater or devised work or, sort of the things that start to break, the things that start to have many, phrases on top of them, postmodern dance, whatever. Mm-hmm. As many practitioners will tell you, it's like, you really don't know what you're doing until you do it. And so you can spend a lot of time thinking through things, and you can spend a lot of time training, and then you have like a pretty good idea of where you're going. But until you get into the rehearsal room or the house and like start making stuff inside of the house, you don't really know what it is. And then you can evaluate, and then you use your analytical brain and take it apart. I do find that dichotomy is very. It's like very challenging for me to always remember, because I think I'm really interested in research. Mm-hmm. I'm like very, compelled by knowing as much as I can about the topics at hand. Not even because it's going to go into the show, but just because I think that it will enrich my understanding of the space in which the show will happen. I'm talking around a subject, which is, so, okay. A little bit of a story about this house. This house was built in 1915, the house that we're doing the performance in, the Bach House. In 1914, Frank Lloyd Wright was working on a project in Chicago and got a call and had found out that his studio in Wisconsin, Taliesin, had parts of it had burned down, and that his lover, who was living there, had been murdered. It's truly wild. Is like such a dramatic event. Truly happened. It's a very complicated story. And like, you know, it was 1914. The person who committed the murder and set fire to the studio, like drank acid afterwards. And so wasn't able to like talk to the authorities afterwards. So we don't really have any statements from him. But we know that he was employed as like a house servant, and was maybe going to be fired soon, but that's sort of like, it was going to be in like a month or so. I don't know. It is like a really, really, it's very bloody. It's like very emotionally, huge. And like I said at the top, like I have weird feelings about Frank Lloyd Wright. I think that he's sort of like a comically large figure, in part because he made himself into a comically large figure. He was like known for saying like, I am the world's greatest architect, and proposing these just truly grandiose, projects. But like, this is something that is truly larger than life that happened to him. And it happened to him the year before this house was built. And so that biographical detail, I have found myself puzzling over a lot of. The house in Rogers Park is like really, it's a very quiet and introverted building. It sits on just one city lot, which is very unusual for a Wright House. It is also like, it sort of shies away from the street. It's like kind of up. It looks a little bit fortress-like. And on the inside, it feels very protected. It feels like very much like a sanctuary that is away from the like sort of the noise of Sheridan Road. And it's like very easy to... Or it would be very easy to sort of draw a line between these two events and be like, a grieving architect makes a grieving house, which to a certain extent I buy, like that would absolutely impact you. But on the other hand, I also don't buy it. That feels like too easy, and it feels like too, it's like, it is conscripting the house to the life of the architect and not vice versa. It's not allowing the house to have its own life. So part of the challenge of this work has been to like interrogate that history and think through like, okay, what does that mean? And what does it mean to inhabit that house now?
Can we geographically contextualize again? So where in Chicago is the house?
The house is in Rogers Park.
But like which?
Sheridan and Jarvis.
Sheridan and Jarvis.
So like right by the lake.
Right by the lake. When it was first constructed, yeah. There were no buildings built to the east of it. So it had a lake view.
Was it really rocky?
You know what? I don't know.
What you're talking about is fucking fascinating, which is why I'm like, oh, that's so interesting. Well, because it for me, it brings up, I think that we have like iterations of this conversation a bunch, and a lot lately it's been happening with the whole, like, can you separate an artist from his art, or yeah. their art rather? See it, and that's the my little Freudian slip there was like, because every time we talk about it, it has to do with like men that are fucking trash that like, you know, are terrible to women or to anyone really, but it's a thing that happens a lot in art history, which is how much does the biographical information weigh when you're talking about art theoretically? And a lot of people will say that you shouldn't. Like, when at the core of this conversation is that you should not include biographical information. And I think that this is such an interesting case study to that, because it's not the dichotomy to which we're all used to at this point with this conversation, which is, should we separate an artist from his abuses? But instead it's like, and especially with Frank Lloyd Wright, who was like also kind of an abusive artist. Yeah. But like, it's interesting that specific space of like, this case study of like, this is abuses done to him, and weighing that against, because like his whole thing was like it being an outcropping of the natural environment, yeah. like geographically. And I think that's why I was immediately like, whenever I think of architecture in like Edgewater, Rogers Park, I always just immediately jump to, Burger Park, like Burger Mansion. And that to me, when I think about like all the rocks that are on the side of the beach there, which might even not even be that old. Like they might be from like 30 years ago or something.
The
like
rocks?
That. I don't know, actually. Well, and basically the question that I'd love to have someone
write
in. I don't
think that Chicago went to like Rocks Are Us.
No, but I wonder if like, well, because is rocky parts, the rocky side of the lake of Lake Michigan, is that natural to Lake Michigan?
I think so. I mean, because I'm just thinking about the Wisconsin part of Lake Michigan, and like especially like up in Door County and stuff like that. Like all of the beaches are like pebbly, and and specifically like along Milwaukee's Lake Michigan shore, there's like all these like big rocks jutting out into the lake.
It's probably like a little hard to say with the city of Chicago, because the lake, the shoreline has changed so much. Like I feel like most of it is not natural anymore. And specifically up here near Edgewater, it's like right where the cusp was, where they stopped putting in landfill. Like all of Hollywood Beach is all landfill. So like all of that is not natural. But this is my educated guess, which is that I know that like the shoreline of Chicago in its like pre-colonized state was like mostly swamp or like sandy dune-ish sort of like Indiana Dunes style lakefront. So it feels likely to me the rocks were placed there, but I really have no idea.
See, I was thinking about just the kind of like random rocks that are behind Burger Mansion. Mm-hmm. It just occurred to me, you're talking about like the slates of rock. Sorry, I just caught up.
No, it's well, okay, so I want to take a step back. Because now we've, this is a thing.
Now we're just talking about rocks.
Well, and
oh, I love rocks.
We've kind of jumped into the deep end of something about you as an artist that we've mentioned, but I wanna better contextualize for maybe anyone that's listening that
is new to the show.
Is new to the show or new to you. Which is this idea of pulling from Midwestern regionalism.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, is such a fascinating piece to why you've worked so much with your work with the New Prairie School, and it was something that we talked about a lot. But yeah, let's just contextualize. The what has drawn you to that space? What about Prairie is Midwest to you?
Oh wow. That is a good and complicated question. I have like sort of a constellation of ideas for you. I don't know if I have a single thread.
Oh, I love that.
Which is that the Tallgrass Prairie as like a landscape, as an ecosystem, largely doesn't exist anymore. There are patches of it that are sort of preserves. Like there's one not so far outside of Chicago. And this place that I did a residency in Kansas, the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve, is the largest stretch of land that is just Tallgrass Prairie still. But on the whole, it has been, irrevocably changed. It has been a landscape that has been just completely decimated via, the colonization of the continent. Mm-hmm. But like if you look at the like historical record, large parts of the Midwest, particularly Illinois, Iowa, parts of southern Minnesota stretching down to Kansas, were just like all these like huge stretches of Tallgrass Prairie, and there are records from like settlers coming out coming down with what was known as prairie madness, which I think is a really funny phrase, where, a family would settle out on the prairie, and they would build a house, and people would just lose their minds. Like they would have very severe mental health crises, mm-hmm. because of sort of the flatness and unchangingness of the landscape. Which like is just a fascinating little phenomenon about the the history of Manifest Destiny. But I think that it like the, when you talk about the Midwest, when you talk about the landscape of the Midwest, you're talking about things that are built on top of prairie, and all of the cornfields that are built on top of prairie, and all of the cities, and all of the weird stretches of concrete that we have laid out. So it feels really important. It feels really important to when we think about the Midwest to not just think about its contemporary incarnation, but also like its historical incarnation.
Absolutely.
I also think that the prairie as a landscape, just like having walked through the Tallgrass Prairie a bit, is just like a really wild thing. It is like tremendously isolating, and it like it's not so much that it's flat and unchanging, but it is very much that you just like you feel like it's this like kind of boring but also sort of magical largeness to it. I really can compare it a lot to looking at Lake Michigan, or looking at a horizon, which is that there's nothing particularly interesting about it, right? Like it's just sort of a flat line. When you go out and look at the lake, there's no trauma to it, but it still is all encompassing. Mm-hmm. I have this like theory that there are three things that people just like know how to look at. And it's like fire and the moon and big water. And you can take anyone and you can show them any of those things and they'll just be like, okay, I know how to look at this. This mm-hmm. touches some part of me as a human being. So I think that the experience of looking at a horizon of Lake Michigan, I think the experience of walking in the prairie, are like deeply connected ideas. which then gets to this notion of like Midwestern regionalism of like of like the Great Lakes region and sort of like the like Great Plains region being connected in the history of the United States as a place that has like a boring but very profound landscape to it. Does that make sense?
What I'm saying? Absolutely. Well, and I the reason I was like, oh well, let me, and then I was like, never mind, because the big water thing kind of encompasses that horizon in a weird way. Like that is so.
Well, I remember last time we talked about kind of, you know, likening a expansive prairie to the expansiveness of Lake Michigan and how like they're kind of, because I think that's a through line in the book, in the art book.
Yeah.
Was likening, you know, staring out over a really vast prairie to staring out over a really vast body of water like Michigan or Lake Erie or something. But vastness.
But, so the thing that I like about this is that it takes something that like is specifically kind of is used to put the region down, right? Like the flatness of the landscape is often proclaimed as a reason why it's boring to live here. And it sort of reclaims it and it says like, oh, this is actually very interesting. And it like, and it takes a little bit more careful attention, but it is a source of maybe profound inspiration or growth or something. I think likewise, sort of in like a parallel complementary world, there's also like a very rich history of like leftism and progressivism within the Midwest, mm-hmm. that is also often paved over in favor of this like kind of cultural narrative of the heartland, mm-hmm. Of like everyone is a straight family who lives on the farm and has like 2.5 kids and a dog, which like is just like so not true to the experience. You know, like I grew up near Toledo, Ohio, which is a place that like has like a very distinct urban landscape, and we live in Chicago.
I brought up Willa Cather the last time you were here, like the same thing of like how learning. I remember when I first was reading Willa Cather and learning about Lincoln, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. It's like the same thing of like you did, like how much. Like, my Antonia was my Antonia because of her progressivism and because of that awareness of race and of cultural significance in the prairie, which is, it's exact, like, you're exactly right, that it is, and, you know, I always find it really interesting that it's always in the places that are hardest to live that people are more willing to be open. And accepting, like that's why socialism is so big in like the great Nordic North, because like it fucking sucks to live there. It's cold, like it's miserable, like it's hard to find food. Like it's the thing that's really interesting is like the things that are, you know, good human practices, at least if you're, you know, if you're left of the aisle, if you're listening to this podcast and you're not left of the aisle, like the Scoppy Radio podcast, like how did you find it? Like, congrats, like
send us an email.
Like, welcome. I wanna know, like, let's talk about it. Like, what have you been thinking this whole time? But I what was I saying?
I don't know.
I think it's fascinating. And well, so actually I think this is an interesting why else will cut you off?
Oh, no. So the only thing that I was going to add is just that, like, I think what this all sums up to is a looking at the word regionalism and thinking through, like, place-based identity, but also place-based art-making and place-based, like, living, mm-hmm. As a potential source of you know, political action. In that, like, in making an artwork about and for the Midwest, can be a political gesture, and that, like, you can, you know, you have to supplement that. The, mm-hmm. Like, you have to, like, have the work. You have to put in the work as well. But like, regionalism as an idea can be a focal point, mm-hmm. I suppose, is like, kind of the fundamental argument of the New Prairie School.
I want to take more of a snapshot of this moment, of this work that's coming up in the next couple weeks, because one of the things I know that you've touched on and we talked a bit last time was Frank Lloyd Wright's sociopolitical influences and experience. Uh-huh. But what I also think is really interesting is that it feels as if this is not addressing that, not addressing, but what you've focused on is this emotional space,
yeah,
which I think is really cool. And I think that even in not... even in making sure to not overlook his sociopolitical spaces, it's very valid to still focus on that emotional space.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious for you, has there been a weighing of the scales to make sure to not let the I'm sure complicated thoughts that you have on his, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright political thoughts, like, has there been a conscious effort to keep that off the scale in your work this time around? And if so, why? Like, what are you working to expose instead?
I think that specifically in this show, I think that my hope is to use the figure of Frank Lloyd Wright to get people in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Lloyd Wright has done all of this work to make himself into this, like, larger than life figure. And so that, like, anything that has to do with one of his houses immediately gets a lot of attention. A lot of people start to look at you. And if we can invite people in and trick them, maybe not trick them, that's sort of a mean way to say it. If we can invite them in, and have them be surprised and delighted by the experience of, like, having to, recognize vulnerability, right? Like, I think that the secret to this house is that a house is a really vulnerable thing because you need it. Like, it's the bottom of the pyramid in terms of, like, of the hierarchy of needs, or one of the bottoms of the pyramid, is, like, shelter. Is you need some place to, like, lie down at the end of the day. And that, like, that thing is the is like one of the closest things to, like, a true, like, universal truth that can, like, bring us together and be like, oh, actually, like, you know what, we all need a place to sleep at the end of the day, we all need healthcare, is, like, I think is an easy leap to make from, like, the political perspective. I've been struggling with, like, with how much of Frank Lloyd Wright to include into the piece. I think I've settled on a pretty good middle ground where we talk about him outside of the house, and then inside of the house we maybe don't talk about him as much, which feels like a good way of like denying him the authority inside of the house and allowing everyone to have their own experiences, to truly, like, get the experience of being sheltered, which is I think the emotion that I'm trying to get at.
That is, I love the way that you said that we make sure that he's not the authority in the house, because it kind of harkens back to the thing I was talking about, because I'm really working hard to try and understand this, like, structure thing that I'm trying to build, which is having I want to find a better word for it, but the idea of an anti-goal. Like, in the same sense of, like, an anti-hero, like Frank Lloyd Wright, giant marker on the Midwest, in some good ways and in some terrible ways.
Yeah.
But I think that the idea of that, at least in regards to the house, is, like, such an interesting thought of, like, working to push away the authority of Frank Lloyd Wright as strongly as possible. Like, that is such a, I'm fascinated by that.
Or also to abstract him,
sure.
So that once we get into the house, he's, like, nothing more than a symbol. He's, like, just the same as the window pane, right? It just, like, it's something that informs your view of it, but does not dictate your view of it. I'm interested in his life as a source of like metaphorical potential. And I'm not super interested in telling the story of him, though, you know?
Absolutely. Cool. Well, we have a few minutes left, so the last thing we do with all of our guests is a one-minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes that's very obvious, like letting people know where they can attend an upcoming run of performances, if that were a thing that you were participating in producing. Otherwise, we love hearing shout-outs to other folks that are doing dope work, or any media that you're consuming, self-care or otherwise, music, movies, TV shows, things like that.
Yeah, so many things come to mind. Oh my gosh. First and foremost, if you're interested in what you hear, the performance Essay on the Emil Bachhaus, that's E-M-I-L space B-A-C-H, is happening on February 9th and 10th. There are performances throughout the day. Tickets are between $10 and $25, depending on your income. You can find out more by just like Googling Essay on the Emil Bachhaus or prairieschool.brownpapertickets.com or my personal website, CoreyDS.com. But otherwise, there's so many things happening in the next couple weeks. So like real quick, the Hot Kitchen show at Steppenwolf is great. That's happening every Thursday for the next couple weeks. If anyone is listening like now or tomorrow, the International Puppet Festival is happening, which like any show you see is going to be amazing. In particular, the Mock Rep Neo-Futurist show blew my mind. It's like maybe the best work of art I've seen in the past year. I think it's sold out, but if there's any way you can get in, try to get in. It is popping. It's so good. Also In Time Festival is happening the first couple weeks of February, which is like a wonderful performance art series. Check it out. I don't really know what the events are, but I'm certain that all of them are going to be good, and I know I won't be able to see them because I'll be in rehearsals. So go for me. Tell me about it.
What a good season for performance art, the winter, huh?
Truly. This next month is stacked.
Well, I've, for the longest time, wanted to see Muck Rep, because, like, I know a couple people that have worked with them in, or that worked in it, you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's awesome, thank you.
They are, like, they're doing some of the strangest and most exciting work
around. But, like, what around. A cool collab, like, them and Neo Futurists, that sounds fascinating.
It's a dream. It's a nice. Dream team.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much. I've been Daniel Johansson. Maureen Smith had to run to a gig, so she is not here right now. But she just left in the last few minutes. She's been here the whole time otherwise. If you want to keep up with what we're up to, there are so many ways you can do that. The first is to head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our articles there, as well as all of our podcast episodes. Also, if you want to find us on social media, we have a Facebook page called Scopy Magazine. We also have a Facebook group that we love and adore called Sounding Board. I'm going to plug that one the most because that space is really great. I mean, actually, I'm going to take this moment. We're always considering like leaving Facebook. I'm sure that that's a thing that many people have been thinking about and dealing with in the last few months. So, I might post this in Sounding Board at some point, but that group right now still exists, and it is like the most important space to us because it's such a community built group. So figuring out where to move that is something that we're also thinking about, or not move, but maybe have a second home for people that want to be a part of it and not be on Facebook. Anyway, that's just the thought I wanted to verbalize and have recorded so that I can like be like, that's a goal I'm setting, you know? Anyway, otherwise, Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr under Scopy Mag, spelled the same way as the website, S-C-A-P-I-M-A-G, and the podcast, the one you're listening to right now, Scopy Radio. I'm going to do Maureen's part, and I'm going to butcher it. So, if you want to support what we're doing and want to do that either financially or through sharing it, one of the things that you can do, all the things that are fall under the subscribe tab on the website, the first is subscribing to emails. There are a lot of ways that you can subscribe, but subscribing to emails is the way that you are insured to receive everything we post. Some people may not want that, but some people may do. And what happens is anytime we post an article, or anytime we post a podcast episode, anything gets published to the website, you will get an email about it first. It's the most assured way to know when we're publishing. So we always want people to know about it because that's, you know, the ultimate goal is for you to know what we're up to. Otherwise, you can subscribe financially, which would mean the world to us. We have multiple levels of donation, $5 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month. Each of them come with different little prizes. Like, we actually have, like, for each of them, we have, like, tote bags and coffee mugs and stuff like that. Check it out on the site if you haven't already.
If I may, right there, I am a monthly donor to Scoppy Magazine. It's the easiest thing in the world, and it does it. The like, NPR thing, the NPR pitch, where they're like, you will feel good about yourself. It's true.
I really appreciate that. And it's,
give your money to these people.
And we'd rather, you know, it's an interesting thing, right? Because we're, like, at a point where we want to be able to fund the work that we're doing. I mean, we have writers that we pay. We have, like editors. Like, Maureen and I both do this volunteer, basically, at this point, because we want to make sure that all the people that donate their time and give their time, like, that we're able to compensate in some way. And so that is, in every way, like, if you donate to the website, like, to the magazine, that is where it goes, is making the parts that make our volunteer jobs easier happen. And that's what we do with our funding. And the other piece that's another thing that we always talk about is advertising. We like create content and have advertising space on podcast episodes and our website for local businesses. We also create videos for people, can do that. So if you are interested in that, head over to the Advertise With Us section on the website. And that is if you are a entity of some kind and want to support the magazine, we love coalition building, love getting to know local businesses and local makers. So give a little, give a lot. And if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share. Thank you so much again for listening. Go out and make something. Yep.